thank you. Okay, we have two great platform speakers today. It's my privilege to introduce both of them. The first that I'd like to introduce who will speak to us this morning is Paul Shevlin. As I read Paul's bio, could I share with you one perspective that I hope, as we are here, that we can take from? And you'll see that Paul is the embodiment of servant leadership. In the 20-plus years that I have attended and participated with Taggart, Paul is perhaps as credentialed in our industry as any person that we've had come speak. Let me share with you a little about his background. Paul Shevlin has, throughout his career, been an individual who has given back to our industry. In addition to building one of the premier agencies in the country, he has served as president of GAMA, is an LUTC board trustee member, is secretary of the board of trustees for the American College. He's been president of the Philadelphia NALU, which is now NAFA. He's been president of the Estate Planning Council and the Philadelphia GAMA. He is a GAMA member Hall of Fame. That in and of itself, as you take a look at the accomplishments that Paul has fulfilled and done in his life, it's an honor and a privilege to have him here. And I introduce Mr. Paul Shevlin.
Thank you. David, thank you for that introduction. You guys are lucky here in Utah. You have one of the finest general agents in the life insurance business right in your own backyard in Salt Lake City. He's a wonderful person. This is the Letterman and Thanks for the Memories, which is the title of my talk. Memories. You reminded me of something. You know, I've belonged to all of these organizations for so many years. In the 60s, I was in NAFA, NALU, and I was president of the health insurance organization in Philadelphia. Turn it down. And believe it or not, how many years ago is that? 50 years ago? 40 years ago? Whatever it is. National healthcare was on the horizon. So they gave me the job of going to Washington and talking to the two United States senators from Pennsylvania. Hugh Scott, who some of you may remember, and Arlen Specter, who probably all of you remember. And I had a video presentation. I had a little machine, you know, like computers today. There weren't any computers, and I turned it on, and I gave this presentation. And needless to say, we never had national health care. It's taken all these years for it to happen. So what David is saying is right. I can tell you that I was in the room at the American College in 1986 with Jack Bobo, who was then president of he was the chief executive of NALU, when they dropped the interest deduction on life insurance. You know, a lot of you probably think you could never deduct life insurance interest. John knows that in the old days you could. And the leverage and arbitrage that you used to get with a life insurance product, particularly in the higher income marketplaces, was phenomenal. And they, in 1986, and I think Ronald Reagan was president, they knocked it out. So they can do anything they want to do, and they can ruin your life and your business. So pay attention, join. There isn't any question that NAFA has, NAALU, have a lot of attorneys that work for them. They lobby on Capitol Hill. They're your best chance of saving your industry. I also, incidentally, belong to AALU, and over the years, there was a class, I don't even remember what the name of it was at the time, but used to give money to, I gave money to Jim Bunning in Kentucky. You know, Jim Bunning was a pitcher for the Philadelphia Phillies, so I kind of liked him. But I remember I sent $2,000 to Jim Bunning so he could get elected. And there were a lot of guys like me. I wasn't alone. I mean, there were guys all over the country that sent money to certain, they told you which legislators to send money to. So they're very active. They're doing things for you that you don't even know about. And the least you can do is pay your dues and belong to the organization. You know, life is, in general, is kind of unique. You don't realize how much we know the same people. You know, it's a big country. You've got a beautiful state here, much more beautiful than where I live, either in Florida or in Pennsylvania. And it's kind of interesting. When I joined NAFA, or NALU, in 1964, the guy that was a trailblazer with NAFA is 40 years in belonging to NAFA, And Grant Taggart was a trailblazer. I was a 23-year-old guy joining NAFA, and Grant Taggart was a trailblazer. It's amazing things. Now, David gave me this book this morning, which I didn't see till today. And I read this book. It's a great book. I don't know who put it together, but it's a terrific book. But, you know, I know a lot of these people. It's amazing in life. You know, Ben Feldman I knew. Rulon Rasmussen. Let me tell you about Rulon. I was president of Philadelphia Life Underwriters in 1971, and Rulon came to speak. He was president of NAFA at the time. This was before he was president of Roundtable. He gave a great talk. I remember I introduced him. And he was going to become, I think, the next year, he was taking a whole year off as the head of the missions for the Mormon Church, as I recall. But I just, you know, to this day, I first thing I said to David when we got here, he said, well, he'll be here for the dinner the other night. Well, he wasn't. He's in the hospital, right? Is he doing all right? Good. I'm glad to hear that. But that's an amazing picture. That's some of these quotes. I know all these guys. Miller Grauer, I know. Jack Turner, I was president of Gamma when he was president of AALU. Bill O'Donnell, the last president of Roundtable from Chicago, I know very well. So it's a small world. It really is a small world. Believe it or not, when I was an agent for 13 years, and I became a general agent in 1976, and the guy that took a chance on me, I had never hired an agent in my life. No one would give me a job. I don't care who you were. You wouldn't want me as a manager. This guy saw something in me that nobody else saw. His name was Ron Bishop, and he gave me a chance. I was the first guy, first person prior to me, the general agent prior to me, he fired, and then he hired me. And I was the first one of many that he did over a 4 or 5 year period of time. Here's the interesting thing was, Ron Bishop was a Mormon, believe it or not. Aren't too many Mormons in the national life outside of here in Utah. Ron was also married to a female president of the Millionaire Roundtable Foundation, which is kind of interesting. Just the little side bits that you wouldn't think about. There's a lot of other things that you and I have in common. Andy Reid is coach of the Philadelphia Eagles, and I happen to be a big Philadelphia Eagles fan. My first Philadelphia Eagles game was 1963. Some of you old-timers will remember that President Kennedy was shot that Friday and killed. And that was my first NFL game at Franklin Field in Philadelphia. I was going to see the Detroit Lions and Philadelphia Eagles. And the big uproar was that nobody wanted the National Football League to play any games that Sunday because the president was shot. But they didn't cancel anything, and they played the game. And like a fool, I went to the game. I think we may have won. But since then, of course, the Philadelphia Eagles have had two stadiums and many coaches. And one of the coaches, Dick Vermeil, kind of changed the franchise around. And one of the reasons he changed it around was because of Isaac Ahema. I'm pretty sure he drafted Isaac Ahema out of BYU, who was the best punt returner and kickoff returner we ever had in Philadelphia. And to this day, believe it or not, Isaac Ahema is still an announcer for NBC television, sports announcer in Philadelphia. I think he was just here the other day. Somebody told me that the other night. Chad Lewis was a tight end. He was BYU guy for the Eagles. I guess I kind of covered everybody. And, of course, my buddy, Mr. McBride here, who is a great general agent. You know, in 1994, I got into the Hall of Fame for Gamma, which was a thrill for my family and for me and for the company. Fortunately for me, every general agent in the company was at that session. And one of the things they did at that presentation in 1994, in New Orleans, incidentally, at the Hilton Hotel, was they put together a video clip of my life, which you got to realize that was 1994. I was, a little younger than I am now. And so a lot of things have happened since 1994. But because of the miracle of the computer, hopefully, I took this clip and I thought I'd show it to you. This guy, incidentally, is Bill Goodwin, Northwestern Mutual, retired general agent from Atlanta, Georgia, one of the best in the industry.
The accomplishments of the Agency Management Hall of Fame, and hear his insights about the art and science of agency management. To help set the stage for this presentation, we have created an audiovisual presentation, and we think you'll enjoy it.
It's 1940. In Europe, Winston Churchill became prime minister, declaring to the British people that he had nothing to offer but blood. Financial experts downplayed the new medium, saying it would not have the impact of radio or theater in the entertainment world. On the silver screen, Henry Fonda brought the harshness of the Dust Bowl to life in The Grapes of Wrath, while Warner Brothers announced that Ronald Reagan had been cast as the Gipper in Newt Rockne All-American. Among the births that year were golfer Jack Nicklaus and race car driver Mario Andretti. And in the coal mining town of Scranton, Pennsylvania, Patrick and Mary Shevlin gave birth to their first child, Paul J. Shevlin, just a week before Christmas Eve, 1940. Paul's father drove a truck for the Pennsylvania Wholesale Drug Company, and his mother worked in the boys' department of the local Sears store. As a youngster, Paul was active in a wide variety of sports, ranging from football to baseball. Paul's work ethic became evident early in life. He earned his own tuition for Scranton Preparatory, a Jesuit high school, by working in a local drugstore after school and on weekends. This early work experience influenced him to become a pharmacist. He entered the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy. After discovering he was not quite ready for the rigors of a career as a pharmacist, Paul decided to join the United States Navy. After boot camp, he found himself setting sail out of Norfolk on the USS Shenandoah, a destroyer tender. After 6 months of chipping paint, Paul convinced the Navy to transfer him to the ship's radar department. Here he demonstrated his tenacity and ability to study by himself. Studying by himself after his regular watch, he mastered the material needed to become a second-class electronic technician, the first ever to achieve that rank without going to a formal Navy school. Before his last year on the Shenandoah, Paul married Peggy Edelman in 1962. They'd met in the Poconos Mountains, a resort area in northern Pennsylvania, before Paul had joined the Navy. Peggy's father, Bill Edelman, was a general agent with the Washington National. Bill Edelman taught Paul a life insurance sales talk, and Paul sold 5 policies to his shipmates on the Shenandoah before he was discharged from the Navy in September of 1963. Paul then traded his Navy uniform for the conservative suit of a life insurance salesman, joining his father-in-law's agency that fall. At the same time, he and Peggy began their family, having 4 children under the age of 4 by 1966. The Washington National Agency was relatively small and focused on brokerage business. In 1964, Paul's first full year in the business, he was the National Rookie of the Year for Washington National, paying $13,000 in first-year commissions on 280 lives. In 1968, Paul had his first field management experience serving as a brokerage manager. 6 years later, while Paul was serving as president of the Philadelphia ALU, his father-in-law died. Ernie Craig, then president of the Washington National, offered Paul the agency but wanted to change it from brokerage to a career operation. Ironically, Paul was uncomfortable with that direction. He opted to join the Vogel Leader Organization as a vice president. 18 months later, chafing under the constraint of working for someone else, Paul became a general agent with National Life of Vermont in Philadelphia. By this time, Paul and Peggy had added an additional 3 children, bringing the Shevlin household to 7 by 1976. 3 are now in the agency in Philadelphia. Starting with only 2 agents, both of whom are still with the agency, Paul began to build gradually but effectively. In 1981, the agency won the Wellman Award as the best new developing agency. The agency enjoyed a dramatic spurt, growing from $30 million in 1981 to $95 million in 1983. The agency's honors included 5 Manpower Development Awards, 4 Gold Awards, and 2 President Trophies from the National Life. In addition, Paul has qualified for the Master Agency Award 6 times. In addition to being an agency builder, Paul has been a tireless worker on behalf of the industry. He's served as president of his local life underwriters and 8 years on the board of the Pennsylvania Association of Life Underwriters. He earned his CLU designation in 1971 and his CHFC in 1982. He also served on the National Board of the Life Underwriters Underwriter Council for 3 years and is on the Executive Committee of the prestigious Research Agency Group. He also served as chairman of the Agency Management Training Council, the oversight group for AMTC classes and the annual field management seminars. Paul also serves as a wheel horse for the Gamma Foundation and is a platinum level supporter of the foundation's work. Paul's contributions to the General Agents and Managers Association is without peer. During his tenure on the executive committee, Paul helped engineer the association's dramatic financial turnaround by designing the Partners in Management Growth Program and creating safeguards to assure that the organization creates adequate reserves to assure it will be able to provide services when field managers need them the most. Paul's stirring State of Association message during Lamp 90 in Dallas is cited as one of the most effective presidential addresses in Gamma's history.
So let's dream of a GAMC where professional colleagues can share ideas freely with their competitors. Let's dream of a day when proselytizing and replacement have been rejected as the acts of desperate men. Let's dream of a day when illustration selling gives way to solving the real financial problems of families and businesses. Yes, let's dream, but don't stop there. Take your dreams and translate them into action. Take the ideas and techniques that you've learned here in Dallas and put them to work in your own company, in your own agency, and in your own life. For you see, unlike Ravel's boleros, our life remains unfinished symphonies. What notes you decide to add to the final measure of your lives are left up to you, for each of us are truly the composers of our own destiny. Thank you.
Paul's community activities include serving as chairman of the St. Andrew's Catholic Youth Organization as a Little League coach and Boy Scout leader. In honoring our 1994 recipient, a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson comes to mind. All life demands struggle. Those who have everything given to them become lazy, selfish, and insensitive to the real values of life. The very striving and hard work that we so constantly try to avoid is the major building block in the person we are today. Throughout his life, Paul Shevlin has demonstrated that the American dream can become a reality, providing you have the willingness to struggle and persevere in the face of adversity.
You know, it occurs to me that one of the things that people talk about all the time when you get older are the golden years. Well, for those with white hair in the audience, they'll agree with me, I'm sure. There are no golden years. The golden years are now, your years, today, okay? Life is not about what happens at the end. It's the journey that's important. Enjoy the journey. Have fun while you're young. I tell my grandchildren who are now in high school, I got one in college, bunch in high school, every year in high school. I got 16 grandchildren. And I tell them all the time, enjoy high school because it doesn't get any better. Really. I mean, life is a journey. I remember when we didn't have anything. And I was in the commission business like all of you are, and I didn't get financed. I mean, I had a Northwestern Mutual kind of contract, you know, where they increased the first year commissions. So, I mean, we had a lot of kids, as you can see. But you know what? It was fun. It was a great journey. When you get to be my age, the problem is you have health problems. My wife has health problems. I mean, it's not easy. Hey, money is not the issue, but there are other issues in life. You know, life isn't all about money. And I don't achieve things. I was in his office the other day. He had me exhausted by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He worked so hard. I remember when I used to work that hard. I don't want to do that anymore. So he's having fun, and I wish I was him having fun at his age, 48. You know, I'm 22 years older than he is. So enjoy life while you can. That's the issue. That's my lovely wife that you see up there. I took her picture. I think that's her wedding picture, and I put it in front of my Mac, and that's how that picture arrived up there. I got to tell you something about Peggy. A couple of people in the room know Peggy, but we were out to dinner one night a couple of weeks ago, and we stopped at this gas station. I was out of gas, and I noticed that this guy that came, it was in the state of New Jersey, and in New Jersey you can't pump your own gas, believe it or not. I don't know why. But they have to pump the gas for you. So this guy comes out, he's pumping the gas. And I says, you know, that looks exactly like Keith. Now you have to understand that Keith was her boyfriend when I met her. And, you know, he grew up to be nothing. I mean, I don't know what he does, but he doesn't do very well. So I turned to Peggy and I said, hey, Peggy, aren't you lucky you married me? And she turned to me and said, Chev, she never called me Paul in her life. Chev, are you kidding? If I had married Keith, I'd be president of General Agency Managers Association. And there's more truth to that than you might believe. As mentioned in the film, it's my other, my son Danny did all this stuff on a computer. I don't know how to do this stuff. That's all right. I think that's all right. Barbara Streisand won't bother anybody. This is the way we were. This is Peggy's dad, who died in 1974. He was the general agent when I got out of the Navy that I went to in business with. And he had lost his shirt being a general agent because he had a heart attack when he was 46. So he didn't want to hire anybody, but he didn't like me a whole lot, but he figured he'd let me come into the business. Now it's too loud. I think he can turn it down now. Where'd he go when I need him? Yeah, just turn it down a little bit. He really didn't like me. I mean, he was Catholic, and I was in the Navy, so when I came to see Peggy on weekends, on good, you know, Catholics couldn't eat meat on Friday in those days, can now. And I would eat meat because I was in the Navy. I was entitled to eat meat. Well, he didn't like that. I mean, that was one of many things. Plus, he didn't like the fact my mother and father didn't have any money. And, you know, not that he had a lot of money, but he had a lot more money than my mother and father. So he really wasn't in love with me, but he let me come into the business. He didn't like home offices. I mean, he taught me at an early age, don't trust any home office. You know, I mean, he could... They were petrified. When he walked down the aisle in Evanston, Illinois, at Washington National's home office, they were frightened. He was one tough Dutchman. In Philadelphia, everybody thought he was Jewish because his name was Edelman. He wasn't Jewish, he was Dutch, and he was tough. He believed in commissions. I mean, he was a general agent, and he didn't like anybody to work for anybody else. That's why he didn't like people in the home office. So about 1968, he put me in the brokerage because the then brokerage manager went to Paul Revere. You told us last night you were Paul Revere. His name was Tom Riley, long before your time. Matter of fact, he's dead now. But I took his job, and this was right after Medicare came in, so it was hurting the health insurance brokerage business, you know, because of Medicare. And I managed to build it up, and I got to know all of the great agents in Philadelphia because that's the people I went to get business from, you know. And so he paid me $600 a month. He said, you know, if you need to make more than that, we'll need to make more than that. I got seven kids. What do you mean you need to make more than that? So he sold life insurance. So I did. So after about 6 years of doing a good job, I went to him and said, Bill, give me a raise. I don't know, a couple hundred dollars a month. He says, are you kidding? Sell more life insurance. You're not getting any raise. He never gave me another dime. In 1974, he says to me, Paul, you make more money than I make. I said, yeah, that's a load of bunk. Well, unbeknownst to me, this is August of 1974, he made me trustee of his estate, which I didn't want to do because there are other kids in the family and I'm an outlaw, you know, and I work with him. I just thought it was a bad idea. A month later he dies. Suddenly, Labor Day weekend 1974, he just dropped dead in my mother-in-law's lap, age 60, from a heart attack. And so I got to, you know, take care of his estate as trustee. He was right. In the prior year, I did make more money than him. When he said to me, you make more money than I do, don't ask me for any more money, he was right. I did make more money than him. And I always remember that. I mean, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's, the important part of that is the commission part. Okay. So why did I come into this stupid business? Well, you know what? I looked around me, and I saw all these blokes getting paid and owned by other people. I didn't want to be owned by anybody. I wanted to decide on my own what I was going to be. So I wanted to be paid based on my effort. What other business can you go in that you can get paid based on? I mean, if you go to Merrill Lynch in those days, they don't exist anymore except part of Wells Fargo, I guess. But in those days, they took half of your commission, and they owned you. And if you left Merrill Lynch, you didn't take your accounts with you. They kept your accounts. I didn't want any parts of that. I wanted to be paid based on how much effort I had. If I worked harder than anybody else, I want to be rewarded for it. I mean, there's got to be some reward. If I work 12 hours a day and you work 6 hours a day, I ought to at least do twice as well as you do. I wanted to work with people. I mean, I went to pharmacy school. I thought it was about people. It wasn't. It was about qualitative analysis, chemistry, biology. I like people. That's why I went there. I worked in a drugstore. I figured I'd work with people. Certainly in this business, people are our most important product. I wanted to do something socially beneficial. I mean, if you look around Provo, Utah, how many people do something that's not so socially beneficial? I mean, the nice thing about BYU is the people that work there are doing something socially beneficial. They're raising our kids. They're teaching them about life. But there's so many jobs. I mean, that's why people are so in love with firefighters and policemen, because they do something that's so, or people that are getting killed in Afghanistan, because they're doing something socially beneficial. Well, that's what I wanted. I wanted something socially beneficial. Now, my early years, I didn't know a soul in Philadelphia. As you could see from that introduction, I was born and raised in Scranton, Pennsylvania. I needed to call people who knew the company. They didn't know me. I needed to have a lot of appointments. At least that's what my father-in-law told me. You can't get along without a lot of appointments. And I needed referrals. I needed people to, I was telling Rich over here, that's the key to the business. You got to get referrals. If people don't buy something from you, it doesn't mean that they won't refer you to somebody that will buy something. You got to get referrals. It's kind of a lost art in the business. You know, everybody wants to do things the easy way. If you want to get referrals, that's the hard way. You'll be successful, believe me. I'm sure John Homer built his business on referrals. The solution, well, Washington National was the company, and fortunately for me, they were in the teacher business, group teacher business, disability business. And they had almost every school system in Pennsylvania and New Jersey as a client. So if I called them on the phone and said, I'm with the Washington National, didn't matter who I was, they gave me an appointment, or at least they talked to me, okay? So they did, they gave me an appointment, and you know, the referrals were a good idea, but there were three guys in the life insurance business in the family. My father-in-law, for one, his brother-in-law, and my cousin, all were in the life insurance business. But my father-in-law said, look, Shevlin, just get 20 appointments a week and everything will be fine. Don't worry about it. He didn't train me. Everybody's complaining about training yesterday. He didn't train me at all. You know what he did? He said, drive out to Purdue University. I got a guy that'll take care of you. Go there for a week to the Purdue Life Insurance Marketing Institute. You learn how to sell life insurance. So that's what I did. Hal Nutt was the director of life insurance then, in those days. Ned Hellmuth, do you ever remember Ned Hellmuth? He was the teacher there. Tommy Underhill was the teacher. Both of those guys are with National Life, incidentally. But so that's what I did. I went out there for a week and came back, and that was the all the training I got, unless I initiated it myself. 20 appointments a week. Is it hard to get 20 appointments a week? How many people in this room have 20 appointments a week? Woo! Two or three. It's pretty good. You'll be successful. Well, because I had 20 appointments a week, they didn't all keep, obviously, but I wrote a lot of lives. And believe it or not, 14,000 in commissions, which are all life in DI, in 1964, if you extrapolate it out to today, it was probably a lot of money. It was enough that I, as a young guy, 24, 25 years old, they had me at the Edgewater Beach Hotel in Chicago giving a talk, you know, which was crazy. First talk I ever gave in my life. I was rookie of the year with the company. That's why they wanted me to talk. Now, there's problems with everything, you know. When you have a problem, sometimes good comes out of it. When you have a lot of good, sometimes bad comes out of it. This is the other side of the coin. Teachers don't buy any more than once. So they weren't a good foundation to build a career on. Okay, that's number one. The business always gets harder. I don't know how many people in their first year, but the first year can be the easiest sometimes, certainly the second year. But boy, the fourth year, the fifth year, the sixth year gets harder. I'm sure some of you are shaking your heads. You're in that situation now. That's just the nature of the animal. I don't know what it is, but it works that way. In my day, a stock company was very tough to sell. It's probably not as tough today. But I got to tell you, in Philadelphia in 1963, 95% of the agents were with mutual companies. And the best agencies in the city were mutual companies. I'm talking about Connecticut Mutual. The only stock company that had a great agency was Connecticut General. But everybody else was Connecticut Mutual, Mass Mutual, Equitable, New York Life, Northwestern Mutual, National Life, which I wasn't with at the time. But the only stock agency that I can think of that was any good was Connecticut General. And of course, they don't exist anymore either. And you know, and then the problem they have being in the commission business and having five kids in 6 years. My wife did not work. She hates it when I say that, because she did work pretty hard. But she never worked outside of the home. She took care of the kids and And incidentally, behind every successful person, there's a successful spouse someplace. I don't have to tell you that, but it's a critical part of life. I would never hire an agent without interviewing the spouse, whether it be a female or a male. And a lot of times I didn't hire people I liked because my wife said, don't hire them. And she was right. I mean, it's a critical part. This is a loving kind of business. You got to be in love. You got to love your kids. You got to love your wife. If you're going to screw around your wife, you're going to screw around your clients. Or vice versa. If you're the wife and you're going to screw around, you're going to screw around on the clients in the business. I don't want that. I don't want anybody that's got any ethical problem. I don't care how much business they do. I don't want them. So what did I learn as an agent? I keep in mind I was an agent for 13 years. Knowledge is power. I mean, I went and got my CLU, I got my CHFC, I got my master's degree from the American College. When I went to get my master's degree from the American College, they said, what, are you crazy? You don't have an undergraduate degree. How can we give you a master's degree? I said, well, what can you do about that? And they said, well, you can take a test at Temple, and it's a college GED test, and it takes 2 days, and if you pass it, we'll let you in, get the master's degree. So I went to Temple for 2 days, I passed it, and they let me in. And I got my master's degree in 1981, so a lot of years ago. Discipline is key. I don't think there's anything more important, and I think I heard that yesterday on the podium here by everybody almost, about discipline. You got to be disciplined. You got to do the right things first every day. I was telling the guys yesterday, this is the honest to God truth, and David could do this. I never opened a piece of mail during the day. Now, you might say you're crazy. No, I don't want to. What do I want to open mail for? It gets you derailed. You read a letter, I got to do it. You go this way, you go that way, you go that way. I don't want to do any of that. I want to do the important things. In my case, because I was a general agent, recruiting, training, supervising. I didn't want any parts of any mail. I sat at the television at night with a pile of mail that high, opened it and threw it on the floor. Watched television, threw it on the floor. Every night I would have a pile on the floor or on an airplane, and there were a lot of those where I'd bring two briefcases, one full of mail. But I never open mail during the day. I always tried to do the most important thing. It's all about discipline. Who you associate with and referrals are the key to the business. I mean, I got three kids in the business. I mean, join a country club. Be around people who make money. Buy a house beyond your means. Live in a good neighborhood. Go to a church where wealthy people. All of your associations should be with people that are. You're going to make what they make. If you want to make $50,000 a year, go around, run around with 50, people to make 50. If you want to make 500, run around with them. But that's what's going to happen. That's life. You can't change it. If you don't take those steps, the rest of it ain't going to work. Take risks. I mean, life is risks. The difference between great agents and average agents are they take risks. John, I'm sure, has a big staff. Clay, I know you have, what, five people working for you? You got to take risks. What dentist or doctor do you know that you go in their office, they got three and four people working for them, 20 people in the waiting room, and half of their income goes for expense, half of their income. Now, in your case, probably 99% of the income goes to your family. That's the problem. You ought to be working at 50 or 60% and spending the other 40% to promote your business. Take a risk. As a general agent, David, I can tell you this, the guys that took risks succeed. The guys that don't take risks, they don't succeed. I took a lot of risk. I never thought about it. I never even questioned. I never thought about money. I was always more into the journey than I was money. I knew if I did the right things, good things would happen. My last overdraft, an overdraft in the National Life terminology is, as Kathleen knows, you got to send money back to the company 30 days after you pay out money. You use their check to pay it out, so the vendor is guaranteed to get paid. Then they send you a bill. 30 days, you got to pay them. You know what I paid them the last month as a general agent in December of 2003? $99,000. My son was a general agent, too. So I said to his mother, I said, should I argue about this? She said, pay it. Just get it over with. I paid it. $99,000. I probably gave the National Life $3 or $4 million in the 27 years for the privilege of being a general agent. These were expenses that I paid personally. Things I'd change. I really wish I was with National Life from the beginning. I spent 13 years with other companies. And forget about National Life. I don't think it's a great idea to move around. You know, back in the late 80s, National Life had some problems and people were, and I was president of Gamma, people were trying to get me to move. And they would say, well, you'll bring your agents, right? I said, look, if you want me, you get me. You don't get any of my agents. It's not in the deal. First of all, they do things for their reasons, and it ain't a good idea to move from this company to another company. So don't talk to me about my agents. Number one, if anybody leaves with me, he's probably no good. So what do you want him for anyway? I mean, if he's good, he's going to stay. He's not going to leave with me. Was he nuts? Now think about that. I mean, it pays to stay with. First of all, you got to get with the right organization to begin with, and then you got to stay there. And I mean, I think it's terrible. I couldn't believe that talk by the president of the Roundtable yesterday. I mean, how many bad things can happen to one guy? I mean, I remember when Mutual Benefit went down. I had no idea he was with Mutual Benefit. I knew a lot of people in Mutual Benefit. And then to have Katrina, or as he said, it was more the flood than it was a hurricane. I mean, it's just tragic. I mean, how would you not like to deal? You live in this beautiful country, and you're free and easy, and you can do whatever you want to do. It had to set him back 2 years, the water. How could it not set him back 2 years? And how about spending all that time trying to save his business at the, you know, at Mutual Benefit? Join a country club. Associate. I've already talked about that. Associate with successful people. You know, someone told me a long time ago, you make the same amount of money as the people you associate with. Changes I made as an agent, I became a CLU. The year I became a CLU, I made $10,000 more as an agent. That year, $10,000. Following year, it was the first year of CHFC, I made it, I got that. And I got the master's degree in the second year. The first master's degree was 1980. I got it in 1981. I joined Lanark Country Club, where the ex-general agent and my leading agent, who has since passed away, belonged. And he got me in, and I'm past president there. I still belong there. We've had three houses in our lifetime. We still live in the same house we lived in 1971. I was involved in it. Well, you can tell by the Gamma introduction, but I was involved in Rotary. I was involved in the Chamber. I was president of the State Planning Council. Rotary is, I don't know how many people belong to Rotary. Rotary is a terrific organization for this business. I mean, if you don't belong to Rotary, you should. Now, I don't know if it's the same as it was then, but they only took one occupation. Not that way anymore. It used to be that way. And where I was, there were 100 guys from different occupations in Rotary. It was a terrific thing. But it's a great way to meet people who tend to be very philanthropic. They do a lot of good things for everybody. And they're business people, usually, for the most part. So in 1976, I became a general agent. Didn't know what the hell I was doing. I had to go visit some people to find out what I was supposed to do to build a great agency. I had two agents. One was the ex-GA who didn't like me. And he didn't want me to succeed because it'd make him feel better if I failed. So what did I do? This was my game plan. I didn't want anybody else's problems. I wanted inexperienced agents, new young people that I could teach my way and have them grow. And I knew it was going to take some time, but I was a 36-year-old. I had time. Time wasn't the issue. I had to have a system. I'm a systems guy, so I bought into Al Granum's system. Al Granum is a Hall of Fame general agent from Chicago, and his leading agent at that time was David, Hilton. And David Hilton was a past president of Maiden Honor Roundtable. John, you probably knew David, right? And John, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think David didn't look any more like a life insurance guy than John Homer does. I mean, really, he was an accountant kind of guy, very quiet. But fortunately for him and for Al Granum, sometime in 1974-75, the Wall Street Journal had a front page article about Al Granum and David Hilton. Front page of the Wall Street Journal. So I took that article and copied it. And so every agent that came in the agency, I gave him this article to read. And I said, you're going to do exactly what David Hilton does, the one-card system. You know, 25 points a week, which I think, as I recall, required like 15 appointments, 10 kept, 7 fact finders, 5 closes. And if your closing ratio was what it should be, you'd probably close 2 or 3 cases. That was the formula. And incidentally, 7:30 in the morning, every day of the week, you'd meet with me, and you'd have to show me who you saw yesterday, the names, the fact finders. I'd give you the solution to go back to them with. If you close somebody and you didn't get it, then we had to rehearse why. If you're not getting that kind of training, then you're not getting training. I mean, that's what training's all about. You got to find out where your weakness is. Is it up front? Is it in the middle? Is it putting the case together? Or you have a lousy closing ratio? It's got to be one of those three. Now, almost everybody has a problem with one of those issues. Incidentally, I didn't mention this. I'm not too good with notes. But I had this quote here. One time I heard Lou Holtz give a talk. He's a terrific talker, if you remember, just like Joe Paterno was a terrific speaker. But Lou Holtz said, if your today looks the same as yesterday, you didn't do much today. Whew. A lot to be said for that. You know, think about that. If your today looks the same as yesterday, you didn't do much today. Wow. Incidentally, I skipped over it because I wasn't paying attention to my notes, but when I was secretary of the American College, that was prior to that Hall of Fame thing, I signed a lot of CLU diplomas. What they do is you sign it and they fix a stamp up, you know, because you got it. So many designations go out, they just stamp it. I was suggesting to somebody I had dinner with that I probably signed his diploma, but I don't remember. But I did sign my daughter's and my son Danny's. So I have two kids that have their father's signature on their CLU designation. And, you know, that's kind of unique, I think. I don't think that's happened to too many people. Where am I here? Okay. You know, when I came into the business and didn't know anything, one of the things that I did, and I guess you can still do it today, certainly I think the Roundtable does it because I listened to a lot of their tapes, but Gamma has a lot of tapes, and Roundtable has a lot of tapes, and NAEP has a lot of tapes. But one of the guys that was a manager with the Equitable in Texas, I kind of fell in love with. He was a Southern gentleman. His name was J.B. Conway. I'm sure he's passed away today. But this is a quote. An eloquent Southern gentleman, member of the Gamma Hall of Fame, and he was, mentioned on many occasions from this platform, the LAMP platform, which is the same as the round table except it's for managers, that the main job of agency managers is manpower development. You can't teach a duck to chase mice, and you can't teach a turkey to sell life insurance. I said, Jesus, that tells you something about selection in our business, right? JB went on to say that a general agent must be able to prospect for agents, he must be able to sell life insurance, and finally, he must do the right things first. If he does the first and second, the third doesn't really matter. Think about that. I mean, that is powerful stuff. When JB retired, they invited me to be the speaker at his retirement party, and it rained and hailed and everything else, and I never got there. So he retired, and I'm sure today he's probably dead. Incidentally, and the companies don't understand this. They really don't understand it. But the greatest agencies in the life insurance business were built with inexperienced agents, believe it or not. Harry Hoopus in the Northwestern Mission of Chicago, inexperienced agents. Bill Goodwin, who introduced me there, had one of the greatest top five agencies in Northwestern Mutual, inexperienced agents. Bob Savage and John Savage didn't hire other people's agents, they had inexperienced agents. It's every city. When I came into the business in 1963, the Equitable, which is now AXA, New York Life, and Northwestern wouldn't hire you if you were an experienced agent. That was a rule, and the managers knew it. They couldn't hire anybody else's agents. The other thing is I used to measure every year where our best agents came from. You know, I would do a survey every year, every January. And I decided after 27 years there was only one source of agents that were successful. One source. You. You were the best referrals. If your general agent or manager isn't asking you for referrals for new agents, he's not going to make it. You know what a good life insurance agent looks like, and you know people who would fit into this. Just have to give him the name. Let him do the rest. And he should give you something for that. I'll let him decide that, but I mean, I'd give you something for it. There aren't any secrets to agency building either, if there are any managers in here, but you got to recruit. You know, if I don't find guys like you and bring them along and have them become successful, I don't succeed. And you got to have a servant relationship with your agent. You got to be willing to do everything and get nothing in return, because a lot of times you're not going to get anything in return. They're going to fail. They're going to cost you money. And the winners will always give you more than you ever gave them. The losers, you can't do anything about. You got to manage people. You can't just let people do what they want to do. You got to manage them. You got to force them to do the right things first. If you don't do that, they won't. Most of them. There's exceptions. Clay, you're probably an exception. John's probably an exception. There's probably other exceptions in the room. But they're exceptions. They're not the rule. I didn't want to deal with the exceptions. I wanted a rule that applied to everybody. Incidentally, I didn't like big producers either. I don't mean to hurt you big producers, but I thought $5 or $6 million was enough for me. I was very friendly with guys that had members at the top of the table, and they were nervous, shaking all the time. I mean, their agents drove them nuts. Plus the fact, my experience is that if you're a great agent, you absolutely get every dime you can out of the contract. So how are you going to help me? I mean, So I liked $5 million, $6 million agents. They were nice agents. Control expenses. Most general agents don't control their expenses. Now, I don't know about agents, but Jesus, I mean, right? I mean, more failures because of lack of control of expenses than anything else in the industry. Believe it or not. It's a big issue. Then I was very frugal. I had 6,500 square feet max in 2000. As soon as my son took over, he went to 10,000 square feet, and it's like an empty football field now. It's still there. It's a 10-year lease. It's still a big football field. Nobody's in it. I had every office was full, and I'd always say, well, what am I going to do if I hire somebody? You know what? Knock the guy off the bottom. Let him get his own office. But I never moved. And believe it or not, I think he moved out of that space in 2002. He did. I didn't. And that space is still vacant today. And if anybody wants to rent it, they can rent it for less than I paid in 2002. It's amazing. Do what your agents tell you to do. I used to ask my agents every December, I'd give them a survey and about all the employees and all the things the agency did, and tell me what we did right or wrong. And I would always listen to them. I remember when I was a Gamma president, I was in a hotel room someplace, and there was an interview. Remember FNN? Financial News Network, I think it was the predecessor of CNBC. And they were interviewing a guy that was CEO of a company, I even forget the name of the company, it's a New York Stock Exchange company, in Toledo. Ian, he was Scottish, I remember. I don't know. But here's what the question was, the FNN. You know how television is, everything's so fast. He says, in 15 words or less, can you tell me why you're successful? So the guy turns to the FNN person, he says, sure, I can tell you why. He says, we ask our employees what we should do, and then we do it. That's it. It's that simple. You know, they know what to do. I mean, some of the great people that wrote books, Peters, remember Peters wrote that book about, what was it, excellence? This is a 25-year-old book. I forget the name of the book, but that's one of the things that came out in that book. Suggestion, if wherever you see a suggestion box, it came out of that whole concept. You got to be a chief marketing officer. I don't think a lot of general agents and managers are. I thought of myself as my responsibility was to get you in front of people. I knew if I trained you right and I got you in front of people, you could make it happen. And as Clay knows, because he did some of the stuff we did, over the years I made a lot of changes. I did a lot of things. Tried a lot of things. Some of them didn't work. Some of them did. The last thing I tried, and I don't even know what year it was, were seminars. And I had, and Clay's shaking his head because Clay and David both did the seminars about the same time. Was it 98 or something? 2001? Okay. Well, let me tell you about seminars. I bought every seminar that ever was invented. I don't even remember the name of the company in Portland, Oregon. Started with a W. I bought all their seminars. Never sold a dime. I even went out to Portland for a week. I mean, how much did that cost? Didn't do anything. I'm on the airplane coming back from Portland, and I got my mail, and I'm opening my mail, and one of the things I got every week was the National Underwriter newspaper, which, David, you tell me is still, I don't get it anymore. And I'm reading this article about this guy from Louisiana, and it says, I made $2 million last year doing seminars. $2 million in commissions. I said, that's for me. I got back to the office. I called a guy on the phone. I said, can I buy that from you? He said, sure. So I sent him $150, and he sent me the seminar system. So I said, you know what? Agents won't take a chance on this. I'll do it. So I lay out $6,000. I invite, I don't know, 5,000 people. I think 100 show up for dinner at a Marriott in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. And I don't know. We make 30 or 40 sales. More than paid for the, you know, the investment. And I said, geez, this is a good idea. But you know what? You got to have some system here. You can't be paying for every cocktails and dinner for all these people and the mailings and everything else. So I went back to the agency, and I convinced the agents, I will pay for the seminars. I'll front the money. I got a line of credit, $100,000, with my life insurance policies as collateral. You don't think about that with life insurance, right? You know, even my age, I think about I need them when I die, but hey, it ain't bad while you're alive. You can use life insurance for, it's quick money. Nobody's got to know about it. Banks love it, generally. You know, banks today are goofy, but generally they like life insurance. Anyway, I borrowed the $100,000 and I started doing seminars. God, we were very successful at it, and then you guys did it. You were very successful at it. And you know, we knew exactly if we sent out 5,000, we'd get 100, that we'd get 20 appointments, that we'd get 5 sales, the average size. We knew everything about it. We knew how much business we would write, and then we extrapolated that with the number of people that we have to pay for dinner for to find out if you can make money. And I was telling David yesterday that I didn't think any too much of it, and I could never get my son to get me off the, you know, the $100,000 line of credit. So he was a goofball anyway. He kind of screwed up the agency because of drugs and alcohol. And so I went back in one of the times he was in a rehab, and I got my checkbook out, which was still my checkbook because it was my $100,000, and there was $66,000 in it. So I took the $66,000 and ran. And I figured $34,000 wasn't a bad loss. You know, I recovered 66% of what I put into it. But they stopped doing them. They were so successful, they stopped doing them. That's what happens with success, you know. Now, in your agency, as I understand it, based on what I've ascertained the last couple of days, you got people going back to all the people that didn't buy. Is that right, Clay? And they're buying, right? That's what my son Danny's found out. So if you put all these people in a database and you go back to them, and see, they're going to buy. Just get them in a database. Stay in touch with them. You know, when I went into the Hall of Fame, this is not bragging. It just gives you some insight as to how I think about things. But there was a regional guy at National Life. David knows him. You guys probably know him too, Mel Shursky. And everybody in the home office hated Mel. And I love Mel. He was my kind of guy. He was the best regional guy I ever had. And when I found out the CEO was going to fire him, I called him and told him he was dumb if he did it and that I might leave. I was leading agencies. I stuck my neck out for Mel, and they never fired Mel. They were afraid to. So when I went into the Hall of Fame, Mel wrote me a letter, and he said, you know, I've already congratulated you personally, but I wanted to write you a letter just for posterity's sake. He said, number one, it's gratifying to see that there's still some justice in the world. Considering the number of times I've been in your agency and personally witnessed you in action, I can truly say that you work for and deserve the honor of being elected to the Gamma Hall of Fame. Number two, anybody who wants to go forward in their career needs a role model. Paul, during my tenure at National Life, you've served as my role model. You have inspired me over and over again with your courage, your empathy for others, your loyalty, and your work ethic. Now, look, there's servant stuff in there, you know. I've always believed that a general agent recruits people that reflect his own character and personality traits. In other words, an agency is made up of agents that reflect the general agents that recruited them. In 10 years that I've been in a regional role, I've had first-hand experience with numerous operations. I've never been in a finer agency. Your agents are not only competitive and aggressive, but honest, loyal, and considerate as well. They are leaders in the best sense of the word. They're a reflection of you. You get the best because you give the best. Now, there's no way that you can fight the way the business works. The right CEO hires the right general agent, hires the right agent, gets the right clients. That's the way it works. If one of them is out of sync, forget about it, particularly the one up here in home office. If he's out of sync, nothing else is going to work. Nothing. And then finally he says, and you'll appreciate this, Rich, it occurs to me that my golf game is immeasurably better than what I play as your opponent. I'm framed the hard-fought dollar that I won from you. Your competitive spirit brings out the best in everyone. Mel and I won our member guest one. Mel's a terrible golfer. But he won. I didn't win it. He won it. He won the member guest. You know why this is blank? Because I asked a home office 2 weeks ago to give me production, and they still haven't given it to me. It's a typical home office. I was going to take it out, but I said, I want to make a point, you know? Blank. Now, that thing in 1994 said that we did like 100 million in whatever year that was. In 1984, we did 5 million of life commissions in 1984, which probably was almost number one in the industry. And I would say, I don't even know, but I would suspect that every year thereafter, from 84 to I got out of town about 2000, we probably did 200 or 300 million, somewhere around there. So we did a lot of business, even though they're not willing to give it to me. You know why? Because they probably don't have it. They're like most of them. They don't know where anything is. People die that I've known for years. I don't even know they die until it's a year later. It's true. It's going to happen to you, too, believe me. These are the systems. Almost all these systems I've used, and I brought to the National Life. Certainly Al Granum. You can still get Granum system today. I forget the name of the outfit that sells it. They may even be here. It was Dearborn or somebody. I don't know. Wayne Cotton, somebody told me he's still around. We used him for 6 or 7 years. He's got a survey thing. You know, you take in the businesses or individuals and have them complete it. Chubba Sigley, I know he's still around because I was at LAMP in Las Vegas in March and he was there. He's got a great referral system. And I mean, it changes your attitude about referrals. It makes you think that you're owed referrals, which is a nice way to think about it. Mentoring, I started mentoring before seminars. I did mentoring for 6 or 7 years. I don't know how Million-Dollar Roundtable picked up after that and started, but Dick McCluskey started mentoring in Newport Beach, California, I don't know how many years ago, 20 years ago. And it's a great way to get into the business market particularly. I used to, young guys would come into the agency, they have to make 100 phone calls a day to business owners, cold. Now, in today's world, it probably won't work. You know, with call waiting, with cell phones, I mean, you probably couldn't get through. In those days, we could get through. Study groups. I belong to general agents and agent study groups. I was in the RIDE group. I was in a National Life group. I was in the GAS group. Study groups are a great way. I always wanted to learn from other people. Why should I, you know, start something new? Seminars we've already talked about. What I learned. Well, your agents are a reflection of you. You shouldn't hire anyone when you wouldn't buy life insurance from. Now, I say that to you, I have, and they failed. But if you're not going to buy life insurance from them, don't hire them. I did. It doesn't work. You got to get people, your job as a general agent is get agents in front of people. You must control your expenses. I associated with the study groups I were in, I was always on the bottom of the totem pole. It was amazing. I mean, the agencies were always bigger than mine. Discipline is the key for everybody, including my middle managers, which are hard to find, incidentally. Buy only whole life insurance. Plan your estate using life insurance. Buy your life insurance for life. This is some of the life insurance I own. Incidentally, I had a heart attack at 48. I relate so well to John Lee. And at 63, I near died. I was within 2 minutes of dying. I was rushed to the hospital in an ambulance. I mean, I'm lucky I survived. So any life insurance I bought after 48 was conversions. It's the only thing I could do. I couldn't buy it. So I have $572,000. I bought a 48. Dividend pays for it. $4,930,000 dividend pays for it. Age 50, I've got a small policy, and I'm going to get to that in a minute if I don't use up the 6 minutes. Age 44, I bought $500,000. I got a loan on it, so that's why it's $455,000. Dividend pays for that, except I pay the interest on a loan. That was a 4 out of 7 deal. Remember I said 1986, you know, you could deduct interest. Well, I can't deduct it anymore, but in those days I could. It was split dollar. Age 59, I bought $146,000. It's a variable life policy. It's fortunately not in the market, but I still pay the premiums on it. Then I got a universal life policy. It's got to be 25 years old, but they've switched it a couple times. I'm trying to get them to switch it again because it expires at 78. If I don't die before 78, it ain't going to be around. So, and age 49, I've got a policy where the dividend pays. That's a conversion, I think. Dividend pays for it. So what's the results here? All the life insurance, the whole life I bought, the dividends are paying. At age 70, I'm not paying any premiums. However, I got $1,277,000 of variable and universal, all of which I'm paying, and some of which may run out before I die. Cash value, I got $700,000. You know what? I don't even care about the $700,000 of cash value unless I find an opportunity. I really don't. I want the death benefit. This is my family. Can you see that all right? Would it be better if the lights were down? There you go. This is my oldest daughter, Christine. She's a CIU. This is the guy that screwed up. He took over the agency. He's my oldest son. This is a lawyer married to him who's an agent, very good agent. This agent's in the agency. This is my youngest daughter married to him. And these are my two youngest kids, and that's Peggy and I. These are my grandchildren. This one just went off to Boston College. He's a freshman at Boston College. And all the rest of them, all 16 of them. This is my estate plan. I got 3 minutes to tell you about my estate plan. And that's what you should do when you see somebody. If Peggy dies, this is important. Listen to this, because this is a great concept. If Peggy dies, she gets all of my assets. I get all of her assets, excuse me. She doesn't have any assets. Let's say if I die first. One of my policies, that 455, that 500, goes into a residual trust. Does everybody know what a residual trust is? It's a trust that isn't taxed when the next person dies. It's the A and B trust. It's the B, as I recall. I'm a little antiquated, but I think it's the B. Now, here's the key. When that money goes into that trust, the $500,000, it becomes $2 million back to Peggy's age 42. So she gets a life insurance policy at her age 42 when she's 70. What pays the premium, all the back premiums? The $500,000. So here's a $2 million policy inside of the residual A of the B trust. And then all the rest of the assets that Peggy has, okay? Now Peggy dies. Let's suppose the assets are $10 million. She gets, the government gets $5 million, right? And with an exemption, maybe $4.5 million. And all the rest goes into the residual trust. So the residual trust gets the $2 million that doesn't get taxed. They get the additional $4.5 to $5 million. So it's $7 million trust. That trust becomes a dynasty trust. Anybody know what a dynasty trust is? It's a generation skipping trust. What generation am I skipping? My kids. The $7 million gets divided into 7 trusts. Each of my kids get the income from the $1 million and the right to invade the trust. This is not it happens in Utah too. They can invade the trust. Now I'm down to 1 minute. They can invade the trust and do anything they want with it. I mean, I can tell you that trust language is so liberal. You could pay for education, you could buy houses, you could pay for weddings, health, anything. And then when my kids die, which will be a long time from now, my grandchildren get the balance of the money, but there's no tax. That's the generation skipping. There's no tax. It's called beneficiary insurance option. Somebody invented it, a guy from Connecticut General, 30 years ago, and I bought it right away. And then Pennsylvania outlawed it. Can't buy it in Pennsylvania anymore. But Utah, David tells me you can still buy it. Industry hiring other people's agents is a problem. It should be experienced agents. I don't think it's a good idea. Not selling whole life, I don't think it's a good idea, for obvious reasons. The formula for success of an agency is broken. You can't have big office space with a lot of, because your best agents don't want to be in your office. You're an exception. You're in his office, and I think that's great. But it's not the rule. If you go around the country, the system can't support. When I was a young general agent, 95% of the business was life and disability, mostly life insurance. Today it's like 25%, or maybe less, I don't know. Lessons of life. You got to be knowledgeable. You got to exercise. Believe it or not, as ugly as I look, I start exercising every morning, even though I'm retired, at 5:30. Anybody ever do pace? Al Sears' pace, I do pace. That's running for 15, 20 minutes, fast, 4.5 miles an hour. Power 90X, anybody do? I bet you nobody does Power 90X? It's the young guys, right? Just because you have any hair doesn't mean you're not young. Is Power 90X not hard? It's super hard. I got to be the only 70-year-old in the United States that does it. And then I walk for an hour. So I exercise really for 2.5 to 3 hours a day. God, you got to believe in God. I mean, this business is about God. If you don't have any spiritual faith, then you can't. This is an act of God when you give a life insurance company money and they're going to take care of your family in the future. You don't know what the future has to hold. Look what happened with David, Kathleen. You don't know. You just don't know what life is all about. Family. I never wanted to hire somebody that didn't love their family, or love their kids, or love their wives, or their husbands. I didn't want any parts of them. You got to have self-discipline. I already said that. This is Peggy and I. Geez, I'm going to be right on time. Peggy and I and Willie. Willie's our dog. Peggy's cute as ever. Willie's pretty cute, too. Let me just close with this. One other thing I mentioned to Rich the other day, that my son Danny gets all these economic outlooks, and I thought this one, he gave me this the other day. And this guy, who's a hedge fund manager, I don't know where he's from, I don't even know the guy, but he talks about the future, growth industries in the future. I mean, it seems to me if you're in a life insurance business, you'd like to be calling on people that are in a growth industry. Here's what he said are going to be the growth industries in the not in the next year or two. IT, surprise, IT being computer stuff, durable goods, tourism, temporary staffing like manpower and, you know, all that kind of stuff, automobiles, and long-term food production. Somebody came up to me before the meeting. He was in the food business. Food production. And how about servicing the Hispanic population? I mean, there's a lot of Spanish people in the United States, in some places more than others. My hometown of Scranton is half Spanish. It's unbelievable. Anyway, let me close with this. Every speech I've ever given in my life, I've closed with this. It'll take me an extra minute or two. There's one major ingredient for success in our business, just one. And it's behavioral in nature. Think about that. It's important. And therefore, changeable. I'd like to share it with you. The longer that I live, the more importance I attach to a person's ability to manage and discipline themselves. I'm convinced that the essential factor which lifts a person above others of similar background and intelligence is superior capacity for self-discipline. Talent plays a part, of course, but talent or aptitude is not the difference. Education and training are priceless, but education is not the difference. While there are those who prefer to believe otherwise, luck or good fortune is not the difference. Thomas Jefferson was right when he said, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find the harder I work, the luckier I am, although Thomas Jefferson was a pretty smart guy. Raw intelligence certainly helps, but it's not the difference. The Army, see, I got something here for the Army. The Army has given IQ tests to millions of soldiers, and they found as many instances of high intelligence in the ranks of enlisted men as it did with the officer corps. In other industries, studies suggest that there's much brain power on the assembly line as there is in the executive suite. Certainly that would be true in General Motors' case. The conclusion is inescapable. Intelligence, not the answer. No, it's not talent. It's not formal education. It's not luck. It's not intellect. Instead, the single most important factor in determining a person's success is their capacity for self-discipline. I mean, for me, this is a realization that's an exciting concept. Other attributes may be dependent upon heredity, environmental factors beyond our control, beyond the capacity for self-discipline we can generate ourselves. You can go back tomorrow and change the way you do things. What a wonderful gift that this one ingredient we need the most for success is ours for the asking, if only we ask, we do it. Now, let me just tell you one quick story, and this is probably another minute, but Michael Jordan, when he came out of college, was the second pick in the draft. Chicago was lucky. The first people picked a guy that never made it. They picked Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan could not shoot a lick at North Carolina. He was a dribble guy, go to the basket, but he couldn't shoot. You know what Michael Jordan did to become a great shooter? Every day after practice, 500 shots from wherever he shot from, like 12 feet, 13 feet. So, I mean, that's what you have to do. You have to be disciplined. You have to practice. You have to be as good as you can be. Thank you.